From VOA in Washington, this is Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Tom DeFrank, contributing editor at National Journal. Joining me on the show this week are Stephen Collinson, senior reporter at CNN Politics, and Tim Mack, senior congressional correspondent for the Daily Beast. And here are the issues. A nuclear deal with Iran was again front and center in Washington. And not just because the U.S. and other world powers prepared to begin another round of talks in hope of reaching a final settlement by June 30th. In a rare moment of bipartisanship, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee passed a bill allowing Congress a say in reviewing any agreement that is reached. After a few modest changes, the White House, which had said President Obama would veto the measure for meddling in his ability to conduct foreign policy, decided to withdraw its opposition. On the eve of a new round of talks, Russia announced it would sell $800 million worth of sophisticated surface-to-air missiles to Iran. The Russians claim the missiles were for defensive purposes only and did not violate Western sanctions against Iran, but the development was received poorly by the Obama administration and Israel. Iraq's Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi visited Washington and agreed to disagree about Saudi Arabian airstrikes in Yemen. Abadi said the strikes raised the specter of wider sectarian turmoil in the region. President Obama pronounced his support for the Iraqi regime and agreed to give the Iraqis more military aid, but it wasn't clear he was prepared to approve some of the more sophisticated offensive weapons Baghdad is seeking. Meanwhile, the 2016 presidential race gathered new momentum with the formal announcement of two heavyweights, one Democrat and one Republican. Senator Marco Rubio, a Cuban-American and Republican, said he planned to be the face of the future, criticizing some other candidates as the face of yesterday. On the other side of the aisle, Hillary Rodham Clinton, to the surprise of nobody, entered the race heavily favored to win the Democratic nomination. She also said she would run a campaign to make America's future brighter, emphasizing policies to begin the middle class. Well, let's start, instead of domestic politics, let's start with geopolitics here. Stephen, let's talk about these talks, which we're going to resume in a few days here to try to turbocharge the deal. But before that, I think we should talk about the congressional logjam, which has apparently been broken here. And I think it was broken because President Obama agreed to give Congress an opportunity to assess any nuclear deal. But the Republicans made some changes to their legislation. Tell us about that, and what do you think about it?
Right. You know, we've had this long-running dispute between the White House, not just Republicans on Capitol Hill. Some Democrats are quite skeptical of this Iran deal. So all along, President Obama insisted that this isn't a treaty. He has no obligation to send this to Congress. The big problem is that many of the sanctions that are going to be lifted, supposedly under this deal, are congressional sanctions. So in the end, they will require Congress to weigh in. I think they've come up with Bob Corker, the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, has done quite a good job in coming up with an elegant solution, which does represent a climb down for the president. He is allowing Congress to have a say, but there's almost a safety valve in this. Even if Congress gets the deal, passes a bill decrying the deal, he can veto that. Then it goes back to the Congress, and there has to be this process whereby each house has to get a two-thirds majority to overturn a veto. In that scenario, I think it's unlikely that even Democrats who vote to sort of decry the deal will then vote against the president's veto. He only needs really to hang on to 34 Democrats in the Senate to allow this deal to go forward. So I think it does represent a climb down by the White House, but it's a climb down in such a way that will not, I think, necessarily derail the diplomatic process and cause Iran to walk away from the table, which was the White House's big fear all along.
Tim, as I understand it, one of the sticking points that was resolved, at least for the moment, is that Congress won't be able to weigh in until after a deal is reached. I mean, I think the president was worried that Congress might be in a position where they could express disapproval legislatively before there was a deal. I gather that problem has been taken care of now.
Well, there's been a lot of tension over the last 6 months about whether or not Congress might, for example, move ahead with additional sanctions before the Iranian negotiations have even completed. So Congress stepped back a little bit from that, and it decided to give the Obama administration a little bit more time to come to this framework agreement, this tentative framework agreement that we saw earlier this month, a couple weeks ago. Now what we're seeing is Congress taking yet another step back and saying, hey, we will allow you to finish whatever deal it is that you're negotiating with Iran before weighing in, which is a win for the Obama administration. Where the Obama administration has backed down is where, like Stephen said, it is said, well, we will not veto this effort to have congressional weigh-in, congressional opinion expressed after the deal is reached. I'm not sure I agree with Stephen in the sense that I think that the Senate is more likely to be able to present a veto-proof majority. Where I think there should be some concern is actually the House, which has been relatively quiet, even though it's Republican-controlled, has been for some time, and has some of the most hawkish lawmakers in all of Washington, D.C. What the House is that it has a House Foreign Affairs Committee, which is not that aggressive right now about pushing sanctions or pushing this Corker bill. And we'll have to see whether Elliot Engel, the top Democrat on the Foreign Affairs Committee in the House, or Ed Royce, the Republican, who is the chairman of that committee, they're going to push very strongly on this Corker bill. I'm not sure that they will.
Well, let's assume for the moment that the legislative impasse has at least for the moment been finessed. Let's focus just for a second on the talks that will be resuming soon. Stephen, how do you sense the state of play is on the merits of a deal or not a deal?
It's going to be interesting because we had the big fanfare of the deal supposedly being agreed a few weeks ago. Since then, it appears that the United States and Iran have clearly different perceptions of what they actually agreed during the talks. You've had several sort of vehement statements by the supreme leader of Iran that basically say, okay, so as soon as there is a final deal, which is due by the end of June, all the sanctions against Iran will be lifted. The U.S. position is that what they've agreed is that sanctions will be lifted more gradually, in line with Iranian compliance to the deal. Now, there's some reason to think that this is all politics, you know, that the Iranians are just saying this for political reasons, for their own reasons, but we're going to find out whether it's politics or if there's real deep disagreements.
We'll come back to this in a moment, but first, time now for a short break. We'll be right back with more issues in the news.
My name is Cal Perry. I've been at Voice of America now for 2 years. In 2001, 9/11 happened, and that propelled me to find a job in media. They were looking for young people who were willing to go with the U.S. military into Baghdad and film that. It was the highest high to the lowest low. There was moments that you found yourself crying over something you had seen, and then moments of absolute elation of witnessing history. I met my wife in Libya. We both kind of realized that in order to have a family and to take a step back, I was interested in returning to D.C. where I grew up and found a home in Voice of America, a place that's really changing. People are searching for a place where they can find accurate information. The internet's changed that, social media's changed that. VOA does a very good job of providing historical context to our audience overseas, context that you may not find everywhere.
Welcome back to Issues in the News on VOA. I'm Tom DeFrank with Stephen Collinson and Tim Mack. Tim, I want to throw this to you about, I'd like to get your take on the state of the nuclear talks, and tell me how you think the Russian arms deal, which Vladimir Putin seems to be very proud of and is insisting that it doesn't affect anything and, in fact, might help get a deal. I don't know. I'm not sure about his logic. But tell me how you think that affects, if at all, the quest for a deal here.
Yeah. On the deal itself, obviously, there's a lot of negotiation left to go. They're quite far away if one position thinks that sanctions would immediately be lifted and another side believes that sanctions will be gradually lifted with compliance and reassurance that the Iranians are going to be going along with what they said they would. On the arms deal, what Russia has decided to open the door to is to sell a missile defense system called the S-300, or in NATO parlance, what's called a gargoyle. And what it does is it can shoot down incoming enemy missiles, and it can shoot down incoming enemy fighters and bombers. And what it essentially would do from the geopolitical sphere is it would make it much more difficult to launch an attack on Iran. If Iran had these systems set up at strategic points, it'd be very difficult for American strikes or any other country to strike at the heart of the country, especially its nuclear facilities. So what it does is it makes it more difficult for the military option to be used in the future should Iran renege on some of the details of this negotiated deal.
So it's still there's still an option that we will have a deal, but if there is one, it could be much more difficult. I think you're saying if the Israelis decide that they need to launch a strike down the road, if Iran reneges on a deal,
much more difficult to enforce the deal if the Iranians decide not to comply.
Okay. Well, I'm sure we'll be talking about Iran in the next couple of weeks and probably the next few months. We'll have to see. Again, both sides are hoping for a deal by June the 30th. We'll see if that happens. Most timetables in this process have slid. They've proven to be more optimistic. So we will see whether this one is the same. But now let's go to Iraq. Iraqi Prime Minister Abadi was in Washington. First trip here since he took over as prime minister, greeted warmly by President Obama in the Oval Office. They had a press conference, but I think it became clear, listening to both leaders, that Abadi wanted more big-time weapons, and he's probably not going to get them. What's going on here, Stephen?
Right, there's always been this tension since the Abadi regime or government came into power, that they want more sophisticated U.S. weapons. They're obviously facing a fight against ISIS, in which the U.S. is helping. You know, there is still some disquiet on the U.S. side about sending these kind of high-tech weapons to a government where you're not quite sure if they may remain in the government forces' hands. It's a pretty porous situation, the Iraqi army, people coming in and out. There's a big militia influence, so that's interesting. The most interesting part of his visit, though, was actually Mr. Abadi gave an interview to some American journalists and basically vigorously criticized the Saudi offensive in Yemen. And not only did he criticize it, he said that the United States shares Iraqi concern about this offensive. The White House quickly came out and said, well, that's not the case. They don't share this concern about this offensive. Even though I think there are some serious concerns privately in the White House in the way in which Al-Qaeda in Yemen has been able to exploit the anarchy in Yemen during this Saudi campaign against the Houthi rebels. But, you know, this was put the White House in a very difficult position. It exemplifies the calculations that the White House is having to make in the Middle East, because you had a Shiite leader allied with Iran, decrying the actions of a U.S. ally, a U.S. Sunni ally in Yemen, and the United States is on kind of both sides of this equation. So it was a very delicate moment.
And the Saudis, of course, fired back. The Saudi ambassador to the United States said, in effect, to the Iraqi prime minister, mind your own business. Take care of what you're doing. We're going to do what we're going to do. So it is a delicate dance. It's a delicate diplomatic minuet here. But Tim, I'm still not clear whether Abadi and his government is going to be more effective than their predecessor government in solving the problem of the Islamic State without more military aid than Washington is prepared to give them at the moment.
Yeah, well, that remains to be seen. But the Obama administration does have more faith in this Iraqi government than than the previous administration, that's at least fair to say. The Iraqi government, supported by militias and by, let's not forget, Iranian military advisors, have made some progress into Crete, and they are launching some offensives. We do see that ISIS is losing some key ground in Iraq, not in Syria, but in Iraq. And so I think there are signs that some of these military operations are being effective.
Well, we will see. We'll be talking about this forever as well. But now let's go back to domestic American politics. I can remember when George W. Bush decided to run for president in 2000. He announced in June of 1999, first in Iowa and then in New Hampshire in the same day. And everybody that I talked to thought that was horrendously early. To be starting almost 18 months before the balloting in November of 2000. But those were light years away. Now we have several candidates already announced, and two of the heavier hitters are already in. And let's start with Marco Rubio. Tim, you were in Miami for Rubio's announcement speech. He is a fresh face, and he's, relatively speaking, he's a kid. He's 44 years old. He announced in Miami at a building where Cuban immigrants were once processed into the United States. He is a Cuban American. His parents fled from Cuba before the shortly before the revolution. He talked a lot about he is the candidate of the future.
Yeah.
And everybody else, in effect, he said, is a yesterday's person. How do you think his rollout was, and what do you think his prospects are?
You know, his rollout was quite exciting. It took place, like you said, in Freedom Tower, which has a lot of historical resonance for Cuban Americans. And he is a young, fresh pace. He's in his early 40s. He is relatively new on the scene, only emerged about 5-6 years ago as kind of a Tea Party insurgent. It'll be very interesting to see how far he gets.
Well, we will see. Time for another break. We'll be right back with some final thoughts.
Life Talk is an hour-long radio and television program in English, Shona, and Ndebele.
The Women's Forum is a response to a call from our own listeners.
Madzimai Eko Studio 7, achitaura nemi.
Women issues need to be covered in depth.
This is an opportunity to women to interact and share ideas.
On Assignment really is designed to be your backstage pass to VOA reporting all around the world.
But what VOA On Assignment does is to put you in the driver's seat with that reporter. So you would see things as a reporter sees it.
We allow our reporters to tell us the details that they weren't able to include in their stories.
VOA Economics Editor Jim Randall, thanks so much.
VOA On Assignment puts a human face to the stories of our correspondents.
That's really what it's all about.
Free podcasts of VOA Issues in the News are available on Apple iTunes.
This is Issues in the News on VOA. Now back to you, Tim. Keep talking about Rubio, because it was interesting to me. He seemed to be indirectly criticizing his mentor, former Florida Governor Jeb Bush, who has not announced but is running, when he talked about yesterday's candidates, and he clearly was criticizing Hillary Clinton as a yesterday's candidate. And yet some critics have already said how forward-looking is Rubio, other than the fact that he's a young man in his 40s. He's against gay marriage. He's against climate change. He's against the Obama administration's policy of some kind of a detente with Cuba. So does that really position him to make the argument that he's making?
Yeah, it's very clear that when he's talking about the candidates of yesterday, he's talking about your Jeb Bushes and your Hillary Clintons. And when he says he's the candidate of the future, you're right. I mean, his policies do not seem all that dynamic or innovative. He's not that extreme. He's very much in the mainstream of the Republican Party. But when he says he's the candidate of the future, what he really means is my personal history is a candidacy for the future. That is, that my narrative is going to speak louder than a lot of the policies I'm going to put out there. That he, as a young immigrant in America who came from nothing, has made himself into something.
Stephen, another criticism of Rubio by some pundits, by some skeptics, is that he has this fundamental problem. He is more moderate a conservative than a lot of what I would call the far right of the Republican Party, and I think others also say President Obama has given first-term senators a bad name because one of the enduring criticisms of President Obama is that maybe he was not sufficiently experienced as a first-term U.S. senator to be ready for the presidency. I hear that a lot. Admittedly, I hear it from people who don't think Rubio is a good guy. Do you think this is going to be a problem for him?
I think he has a difficult route to the nomination. First of all, he's running somewhat for the establishment wing of the party, which is going to presumably be represented by Jeb Bush, who's got substantial fundraising ability. And, you know, as you said, there's this criticism that he's a first-term senator. Rubio would answer that by saying, well, the problem with President Obama was not necessarily that he was only a first-term senator. The problem was that he was wrong on all the fundamental foreign policy issues of the time. So in that sense, that's how Rubio is going to answer that.
Well, I tend to agree with you that he's a bit of a long shot, but I must tell you, I had breakfast a few days ago with one of Rubio's senior campaign strategists, and he said, here is our strategy. Jeb Bush is the front runner. Scott Walker, the governor of Wisconsin, is slightly behind Jeb Bush, and we are a strong, robust third. And our strategy is to position ourselves for the inevitability that Scott Walker, never having spent a day in Washington really, will make some rookie mistakes and will falter. And at that point, if that happens, Rubio then can be poised to move up to go head-to-head against his former mentor governor, former Governor Jeb Bush. We will see about that. It's a long way to go, but I think Rubio's chances are slightly less than 50-50, but we'll see. But let's talk about another candidate who we've been talking about from these microphones for 20 years, probably longer, and that's Hillary Rodham Clinton. I remember, Tim, a few days before the 1992 presidential election, one of his aides told me that Bill Clinton had said, you know, if I lose this election, I'm going to feel sorry for myself for 1 week, take a vacation, and then I'm going to come back and start all over again, and I will win next time, mainly because I will have learned from all the stupid things I did in this campaign. Now, we don't have enough time left to talk about all of Hillary Clinton's missteps in 2008. So, it's hard to know, but do you think that she has learned from her mistakes last time around?
Not from the early days of the campaign. I think, you know, this email scandal has really reemphasized some of the worst natures of the Clintons and the people that surround them. Their desire generally for privacy, for secrecy, and not being particularly transparent. I think you'll see that being emphasized over and over again during this campaign.
Right. Okay. And Stephen, I wanted to come back to you because you were in Iowa for the rollout, accompanied by hordes of reporters who didn't have a whole lot of access to her. How do you think Hillary 2.0 began in Iowa? How successful was that?
In terms of her own political start, I think it was successful. Like you said, she's learned from her mistakes in Iowa, particularly where she took the state for granted last time. She didn't give Iowans the kind of close-up scrutiny and conversation that they like in their primary candidates. So in terms of purely the Iowa situation, I think her strategy of small events and with a slow start was actually quite a shrewd beginning to her campaign.
Well, we'll see. We got 19 months to go. That's all the time we have. Joining us today were Stephen Collinson, senior reporter at CNN Politics, and Tim Mack, senior congressional correspondent for The Daily Beast. This program was produced by Anya Zaleski and John Walker. Our engineer was Bill Barber. I'm Tom DeFrank, contributing editor at National Journal. Thanks for listening.
From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is Jerome Sokolowski, VOA religion correspondent. Our topic on this edition of the program, countering violent extremism in Africa and the Middle East. Our guest, Ahmed Abadi. He's Secretary General of the Rabita Muhammadiyah of Ulama, that's the Muhammadian League of Scholars, based in Rabat, Morocco, and established by His Majesty King Mohammed VI. Dr. Abadi also heads committees within the U.S.-Morocco Strategic Dialogue and Morocco's Higher Council of Education. He is in Washington in the context of these talks. Dr. Abadi previously served as Director of Islamic Affairs in the Moroccan Ministry of Islamic Affairs. He also taught comparative religion and Islamic thought at Kadi Ayad University in Marrakesh. He is the author of numerous articles and books on Islamic thought and jurisprudence. He is also no stranger to America, as he was a Fulbright Scholar in Residence at DePaul University and the University of Chicago. In late March, King Mohammed VI inaugurated the Mohammed VI Institute for the Training of Imams, Murshidins and Murshidats, that's the word for preachers, in the capital, Rabat. The religious training center aims to instill the values of Morocco's open, moderate form of Islam based on the Maliki rite and Sunni Sufism in the next generation of Muslim religious leaders from across the region and the world. The center is being billed as a key element in Morocco's ongoing efforts to promote religious moderation and tolerance as a shield against extremism in the region. Since late 2013, Morocco has signed accords to train imams from a number of countries across Africa and Europe, including Mali, Libya, Tunisia, Côte d'Ivoire, Gabon, Guinea, the Maldives, and most recently, Belgium. The new institute, the construction of which began in May 2014, has the capacity to train up to 1,000 students at a time on a modern campus of more than 7 square acres. It includes a library, a mosque, housing and dining facilities, as well as recreational facilities. Well, we'll be talking about Ahmed Abadi, about this center, and many other issues relating to countering violent extremism and spreading the moderate form of Islam practiced by Morocco for centuries. And Ahmed Abadi joins us here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Carol.
And I'm delighted to welcome my colleague, Jerome Sokolowski.
Thank you. A pleasure to be here, Carol.
Well, Ahmed Abadi, I'd like to ask you if you could talk about the purpose of the League of Scholars to which you belong and discuss your task in Morocco.
The League of Scholars is one of five main components of the religious field in the Kingdom of Morocco. The first component definitely is the Commandant of the Faithful, embodied in His Majesty, the King. His Majesty oversees the whole religious field. And the Council of Scholars would be the second component. This council is supposed to ensure proximity with citizens and provide fatwas. And as a matter of fact, in Morocco, we do differentiate between fatwas and irshad, because irshad is what is existing in the books, whereas fatwa requires ijtihad, and ijtihad requires a whole arsenal of tools and of know-how. Then the Rabita is third dimension, which is the dimension of reflection, cogitation, and research. We do operate through 15 centers of research and 5 specialized units in various issues related to the field. And then we have the administration dimension, represented by the Ministry of Islamic Affairs. And then we have education. Those are the 5 components, and they are working in harmony and in complementarity. And the Rabita is like a religious academia that provides and produces the related content.
Let's talk briefly about this new center that we spoke about in the introduction. It's being billed as a key element in Morocco's efforts to promote religious moderation, for which it's known around the world, and tolerance as a shield against the extremism that we're seeing on the rise. But of course, that's a tall order. Talk about the prospects for success. Talk about the financing. And what comes to my mind is Morocco positioning itself, in a sense, to be a counterweight to the likes of, for example, Saudi Arabia, who has used petrodollars for decades now to spread its rather, one would call, rigid, puritanical, and some would say more of a distorted version of Islam, which some say is the pretext that some of the extremists use to commit violence in the name of Islam.
In Morocco, we do not like antagonisms, so we do not subscribe in this dynamic to counter a country or somebody who are doing it the positive way. We are just trying to share and to communicate what we have compiled throughout, I would say, millenniums in terms of living together. So our comprehension of Islam was quite a specific one, since we have made the difference very early between Islam and Muslims. And we took Islam and we did not take the dynasties that were trying to run the Khilaf in Damascus or after on and later on in Baghdad or later on in Asitana, Istanbul. Now, we had this reflex to differentiate ourselves from the epicenter, and we've had our way to elaborate and shape even the sciences of Islam in our manner. So the sciences of Islam, even though they would hold the same nomination in East and West, but yet their meaning would be quite different in the West. This center is a platform to share and to communicate, since the Kingdom of Morocco has received many demands to train imams from various countries, as you've so eloquently quoted. And this is just a platform. What is more important than that is the content that would be displayed there and the capacities that would be shaped and built in this center.
Let me turn to my colleague Jerome for a question.
Sure. Dr. Abadi, I wonder if you can talk about what you feel has been the pull for young Moroccan Muslims who've been attracted by the more radical forms of Islam, even the more conservative, the Salafi, or even the violent ones. I read somewhere that there have been 1,000 people going to places like Syria and Iraq to join the quote-unquote struggle there. I also used to live in Spain, and I remember the train bombings in Madrid in 2004 were actually carried out by young Moroccan immigrants. And many of them often came from the same neighborhood. I think there was one block in Tetouan, northern Morocco, that had or like up to a dozen people going to Syria. So could you talk about why these people are doing that and what you're offering, how you're going to counter that?
Yes, thank you, Jerome, for this question. But I would like to highlight the fact that compared to what is going on in the neighborhood, those numbers are very small and they're decreasing. And when thinking about that, we cannot but think about what's happened in Sana'a, in Yemen, and what is happening daily basis in Iraq and in other places. This, because Daesh and other fractions of violent extremism have developed communication, tooling, and a narrative. And this narrative is very efficient, because it has been hijacking three main dreams that were displayed in the region a little bit more than 100 years ago. And those dreams are the dream of purity, the going back to the pure version of Islam and Islamicity. The second dream would be the dream of unity after the collapse of the Ottoman Khilafat. Now people have brandished this dream and have been recruiting around the sparkles of it. And then the third dream would be the dream of dignity. Daesh has captured all those dreams, plus the energies that were freed in the Arab Spring. They are basing themselves on some repetitive items that they use in their narrative. They will talk about conspiracy and scattering the Muslim world, and our governors are not doing anything about it. So we need to take things in hand, and please join and help us doing so. Rebuild the unity. And two, the issue of Israel. Three, the issue of colonialism. Four, the issue of double standard. Five, the issue of humiliation in the media and so. Six, the draining of wealth. And seven, the cocktail, Iraqo, Afghano, Burmese, Central African, name it, cocktail. And eight, the value system infiltration. And there are shooting the masses with those discourses that are having anchorage in reality. So the way to address those repetitive items definitely requires the production of some counter-narratives to allow the shielding and protection of youngsters. If you imagine yourself to be a young man of 18 to 30 years in the region and then assaulted by such a discourse and then being offered the dream to realize yourself, to be the head of intelligence in Daesh and to be married to the most pious and beautiful ladies in the world and to have a role under the sun. If someone is half illiterate, is jobless, prostrated, very angry because of the injustices they would see, definitely this is the case in the region. Why the numbers are so little in Morocco and yet decreasing? Because we've been tackling the issue quite a long time ago. It is not born today as a reaction. It has started decades ago. And this what shaped this aura and charisma and created this demand that was behind creating the center that Carol mentioned.
Just let me remind our listeners that we're talking with Ahmed Abadi. He's Secretary General of the Rabita Muhammadiya of Ulamas. That's the Mohammedan League of Scholars based in Rabat.
So is it something about the Maliki school of Islam? Is it something about having a king who is commander of the faithful, having that kind of monarchic authority? Or is it something about being, I guess, on the fringes of the Arab world that you have other influences? I mean, what is it that allows you to undertake an initiative like this?
As a matter of fact, it's all of it. Plus the fact that we've had a geostrategic emplacement throughout our history. Remember that we used to be the Far West before this wonderful country was discovered by the European and Asian logosphere, because it used to exist and people were living here. And thus, we could analyze all the waves that would erupt in the epicenter of the world, in the Middle East, because they would arrive quite milder to our shores. And we could make our choices quite wisely because of this emplacement. The Maliki madhab, of course, is a madhab that exhorts Malikis to take in consideration the context, not just the text, and to take in consideration the modus operandi and proceed to junctions between text and context. Also, highlights the fact that any law has finalities and purposes. And when assimilating those purposes, you would be more flexible because you would have the architect's attitude rather than just the master builder attitude who would insist to follow up the blueprint literally. Plus the fact that the way Moroccans have picked up the pillars of their religiosity were always making junctions. We've been talking about the junction between text and context in ritual. There is another junction in the dogma and belief system that was picked up by Moroccans, which is Ash'arism. And Ash'arism is making the junction between text and reason. It is not just believing, it is understanding as well. Also, spirituality was there, and the Junaidism is making the junction between text and spirituality. Plus, the authority of the commander of the faithful, which is an inclusive position. Faithful is including, besides Muslims, Jews as well. And we are dealing also with the Christian presence in Morocco under this wonderful umbrella.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Ahmed Abadi. He's Secretary General of the Rabita Mohammedia Ulama. That's the Mohammedan League of Scholars based in Rabat, Morocco, established by His Majesty King Mohammed VI. I'm your host, Carol Castiel, along with VOA religion correspondent Jerome Sokolovsky. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. You can also send feedback via email to PCUSA@voanews.com. Either way, tell us where you're from and how you listen to the program. Here's a shout out to a new Facebook fan,
Abdul Hakim Salehi from Kabul, Afghanistan. Well, back to you, Ahmed Abadi. And I would like to follow up on something you mentioned. You talked about the Jews living side by side with Muslims in Morocco. We know this is going on for over 2,000 years, a harmonious coexistence. We know, obviously, as a result of the State of Israel, many Jews decided to immigrate to Israel. But I would like to think that Morocco's very multicultural fabric may have something also to do with its moderation, tolerance, living side by side with Jews for so many centuries, millennia. What are your thoughts?
This, of course, shaped an approach of mutual recognition. And mutual recognition gives you the breath to enjoy others' wisdoms as well. And others' wisdoms, when well used, would definitely generate a wider view, a wider horizon. And then you would enjoy the expertise of what used to be called the other, because this notion of otherness would be simply relinquished. And this is what happened exactly in Morocco. This is the alchemia that happened and was born and raised in Morocco, as well as in some other places in our globe. But in Morocco, we're proud to recall the fact that we were quite successful in enjoying the fruits of mutual recognition between Muslims and Jews in our country.
Getting back to the International Imam Training Center in Rabat, do you have some evidence of success, progress thus far? I know Morocco is actively training imams in Mali, where, of course, we have Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb, AQIM, again, distorting Islam for violent or political ends. How would you rate success so far of the center in its goals?
In this center, in the predecessor center, we always discernate between three levels of training. Fundamentals, and this is a common ground between all the countries that are in our sub-Saharan voisinage, since we're all Malikis and Ash'aris and Junaidis. So the fundamentals are accessible, and we are trying to display them, insisting on the junction with the context. Then comes the second level, which is the specificities of those countries. Reading the context definitely requires local expertise, and this is why we insist doing it with our peers and colleagues in those countries to shape this second level of training. And then the third level would be the challenges that are in the region and in the whole world at large. Those definitely would suggest us to tackle some specific issues and try to prepare a decent and efficient curricula that would respond to those challenges and build up capacities among the trainees so that they can tackle them in an efficient manner. So those are the three levels, and this may be the recipe of such a training, because then the DNA of how Moroccans have been practicing understanding before that, religiosity, will be omnipresent in those three levels.
Now, briefly, before I turn to my colleague Jerome, I know these are early days because Morocco only signed accords in late 2013 and the center was created just last year, but how receptive have the imams from all these countries, how receptive have they been? Do you anticipate really having a strong impact, not just in terms of training, but even, you know, combating these the radical interpretations that seem to be taking hold?
Well, this is based on indicators and indices, because prompts evaluation should be built upon that. And I think, as you said, it is too early to talk about it now, since we have not applied the evaluation system based on those indicators. But optimism is there, and we hope for all the best. And we would say, with all our brothers in humanity, regarding those challenges, we shall overcome.
There have been many Moroccans who've immigrated to other countries in Europe and the United States. How would you advise them to practice their faith in countries where, while there's religious freedom or they're free to practice their faith, they do feel an onslaught of cultural messages from the secular society around them that they may be uncomfortable with?
When you do transcend to the finalities of Sharia, of Islamic Sharia, you would discover an amazing venue, which is the fact that the six main finalities would be as follow. One, the preservation of life. Two, preservation of religiosity and freedom of religiosity. Three, the preservation of dignity. Four, the preservation of progeniture. Five, preservation of mind. And six, the preservation of money and property. We have been working on an index that would measure Islamicity of a state regarding those six finalities. Amazingly enough, we are now discovering that some countries that are not holding this label of Islam nor Islamicity would score a lot better than some other countries that are labeled to be Islamic, which means that the preservation, for instance, of life would be better in some other countries because the health system would be better, nourishment would be better, and name it, all the things that would be in connection with the preservation of life. Preservation of religiosity, it has also indices and indicators, and some other countries that are not labeled to be Islamic would score better than some, and name it, which means that you would have a world without walls. And this starts, as a matter of fact, in 1989 when the Berlin Wall collapsed and windows went up. Our world is different, Jerome, which means that we just need to communicate this to our co-citizens, wherever they are, to understand the real and true nature of our contemporary world.
And so do those considerations outweigh, for the pious Muslim, do they outweigh things like seeing women in bikinis or sexual imagery on television? I can imagine for a young Muslim growing up in Germany and Holland in the United States, seeing all that and then being confronted with the conservative mores of his own community, it must cause a tension in his own mind that may lead him to go crazy.
In the Holy Quran, there is this verse in Surah An-Nur that says, turn your gaze. When you are confronted to such scenes that you are not accommodated with, just turn your gaze. Which means that Islam, as any other religion, would definitely focus on the inner side to build up those capacities. And among those capacities, and one of the most precious among them, is the capacity to say no. A human being, a homo sapien, without the capacity to say no, would not live a decent life, nor a serene life. So the approach should be to build up the individual and the internal capacities, rather than to change the world around this individual. It's like when the immunity system is collapsing within a human being. Any little disease would just affect her or him. Whereas when you build the immunity from inside, from within, then they can live and they can dwell in and they can have and conduct their life in a quite comfortable manner without paying attention to those diseases nor viruses.
Great, thank you.
And there is no compulsion at the end of the day. No compulsion in belief nor in attitude. And the human being in Islam, as in any other religion, is held responsible for her or his acts.
Dr. Ahmed Abadi, back to countering violent extremism and trying to prevent radicalism from taking place. We know that religion alone, or the teaching of the Maliki version of Islam and the much more moderate version in Morocco, in and of itself is probably insufficient, but absolutely necessary. What other factors or measures do you think countries should be taking to, on the one hand, try to de-radicalize those already who have been radicalized and maybe even imprisoned? What needs to be done in a holistic way
We've been talking about three dreams, the dream of purity, which is about religiosity and so on. The dream of unity, which is decency in life and the optimization of the resources and synergy between those resources. This is the socio-economical dimension. And the dream of dignity, to be able to nourish yourself, to provide the others. And justice is one of the pillars of dignity. So justice goes along with transparency, with democracy. And this cannot have a true meaning without the educational dimension. Given the fact that when you have a youngster that would not reach the age of 18 unless witnessing over 40,000 crimes seen on TV programs, on movies, on video games, or simply on the news as factual happenings. If we do not implement in our educational system curricula that would counter such brutality and produce alternatives that would be yet joyful and colorful and without necessarily holding or wearing an adult face, to allow this appropriation, to allow this engagement, and allow also creativity through peers education and so on. If we do not make sure that all those dimensions would be responded to, then religion by its own, yes, would stay as a capital factor, but it is not all the factor.
Another question from Jerome.
Sure. There's a discussion among Western and Islamic intellectuals as well, where some people argue that Christianity and Judaism went through transformations in order to allow the values and the legal necessities that we have in the modern world, to allow for democracy. And the question is whether Islam already has those elements or if something needs to change within Islam in general in order to allow a more democratic kind of life in the Muslim world.
No religion, Jerome, falls on a bare land. It falls on psyches. It falls on aptitude. It falls on previous weltanschauungs and cosmologies and worldviews. And this is why there is always this crucial need to dialogue with religiosity, to derive from it your needs, your tangible needs. And we've been talking about the junction between text and context. This is one form of this dialogue, to dialogue with your religiosity, to derive from it its propositional force to respond to the challenges that would rise in your given context. And this is exactly what the word ijtihad means.
Which is interpretation, right, of the text.
How to interpret the text, taking in consideration the context as well.
Before we close, one brief message you have for all the youth who are listening, who may be, you know, nervous, worried about going toward a more violent path. What is your message to them?
Religiosity is not just majesty, means do, not do, licit, illicit, halal, haram. It is also beauty and rejoicing. And the bottom line of any given religiosity would be to provide happiness. If we are not successful in deriving happiness from our religiosity, this simply would mean that we didn't get it right.
Ahmed Abadi is Secretary General of the Rabita Mohammadiya Ulama, that's the Mohammedan League of Scholars, based in Rabat, Morocco, established by His Majesty King Mohammed VI. Well, Ahmed Abadi, thank you so much for coming in and sharing your terrific...
Thank you, Carol, for having me.
Appreciate your insights.
Thank you.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guest. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. And joining me on the program was VOA religion correspondent Jerome Sokolovsky. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.